Hello, everyone. My name is Patrick Kinney, and actually Remy asked me if I could help moderate this first session. I'm a professor at Boston University, and I have a talk later today. But I'd like now, without further ado, to welcome Grégory Quenet from the University of Versailles-Saint-Quentin, who's going to talk to us about climate and society as a historical perspective. Thank you.
Yes, good morning, everyone. And thanks so much, Professor Slama, for this kind invitation. Even if I think I was quite foolish to accept it, because we have to imagine in 20 minutes talk about climate and society in a historical perspective. And one more challenge is that I will talk about days long before the global warming we are confronted to today. It's not to talk about some origins or to tell that it was the same in all times. There is no way today what we are confronted to is absolutely unique. But what history brings us is kind of deep perspective to understand in which way what we are living is living is unique. And one more point is an understanding from outside. From outside to go deeper into society. And you will see that one of my main points is about to understand how do society make choices? And that's one of the most difficult points. To introduce my talk, I would say that because of this big frame issue, I won't give a complete state of the art. That's not possible, and rather I will focus on some points of methodological significance in order to contribute to your your research program to be implemented. In terms of history, I would like to make the difference between historical climatology, which is a major field. Historical climatology, it's about the historical variation of climate. Second, climate history, which is quite an expanding field. It's about kind of climate perspective upon history, explaining history through climate. And my talk will be more about the intersection between climate and society, the entanglement between climate and society. And there is no better place than the Collège de France to think about these mythological potentialities. Because as Professor Slama reminded us, Emmanuel Leroy-Ladurie, who was professor here, was the one who invented climate history in the 60s. And there were almost many talks in the 60s and 70s about climate, biology, and history that were quite forgotten. But all the questions they asked are still the questions that we have to answer. My first point is about causality. Is it causality, multiple causality, deep causality, or trigger? Let's start with monocausality. And take the case of witch hunt. Witch hunt was a case, there was a debate between Wolfgang Beringer and Christian Pfister about that. Beringer's thesis was about witch hunt persecution in France, Germany, Scotland, Switzerland at the end of the 16th century. And he tried to establish that these waves of persecution were linked to climatic extreme between from 1560s to 1630s. In fact, in some sources, you can find accusation of climatic magic, for example, unnatural weather in the Gestalt Revorum by Hans Linden, for example. You can find also collective demands of persecutions, demands from below, telling that which are the cause of this climatic extreme. This schema was complexified by Christian Pfister with three main arguments, and that's very interesting. The first one is that you can find historical climatology. In fact, For example, the period from 1585 to 1597 was more severe because of crop losses, series of cold and rainy summers linked to volcanic eruption in the tropics. The second point was about geographical variations. In fact, you find witch hunt in several growing regions, such as the Lake Geneva hinterland, but not in the wine growing regions, whereas which were nevertheless vulnerable to clover climate. It means that consequences of climate variation were different between wine and cereal, and because of the point was about livestock mortality. A third point established by Pfister was that the main factor was the transformation of mortalities. After 1560s, a negative vision of a world shared by the elites led them to accept requests for persecutions. So religious and legal evolutions were the main factors. The result of that is a temporal schema that articulates the history of climate and cultural history. If you look at this diagram, if you take the global picture of witch hunt is not linked to the history of climate and more to a cultural and legal evolution. But if you look to local variations in communes and peaks, they are linked to climate and were not explained by historians before. For example, if you take the peak, 1585 to 16th, or 1618 to 1630. A second point about multiple causality. Last year, many books were published trying to put a new understanding of some big political events in relation with climate. For example, Geoffrey Parker wrote this book about a series of violence around the world in the late 16th to the 17th century. For example, the Celali Rebellion in the Ottoman Empire, the 30 Years' War in Germany, the Ming-Qing transition in China. And the result was to establish that they were all combined with extreme weather. They are all combined with extreme weather, but the main point of the arguments is that it's not directly following climatic impacts. It's more kind of a fatal synergy, a synergy between climatic extreme, food shortage, and conflict. Another book well discussed was the book by Kyle Harper, Fate of Rome, Climate Disease and the End of an Empire. In a certain way, the thesis of the book was to explain the decline of the Roman Empire by the combined effect of climate change, famines, and epidemics. The book is starting with the invasion of nomadic pastoralists coming from Central Asia to Eastern Europe, and Kyle Harper named them climatic refugees mounted on horses. And these climatic refugees, the nomadic pastoralists, put the pressure on the Goths who caused the fall of the last Roman Empire. And this Goth just arrived at the time when the empire was weakened by the Justinian plague. So the collapsologist argument is about the combination between climate change and disease. But it was deeply criticized by many colleagues. For example, this paper by Mordecai Eisenberg with five arguments. First argument, we have few pieces of evidence for the supposed catastrophe outside a handful of some literary accounts. And if you look to the non-literary accounts, they are quite silent about these elements. The second point is that for such research, you should add some academic disciplines such as ancient DNA, red bone, etc. Just not take literary sources. The third point is that there's, you have to, you need to explain, to show nuances, diversity of spatial and chronological scope. And in fact, the Justinian plague didn't start at the same time in all the cities of the Roman Empire and didn't have the same consequences. The fourth point is about all the cultural basis that are in the historical sources. And then the last point is that if you want to take a kind of film analysis with climatic factors, you need to make a comparison between different events. And in this case, to make a comparison between the three big plague pandemics, the Justinianic plague, the Black Death, and the third pandemic at the end of the 19th century. A last figure of causality is something that we can call deep causality. Deep causality is that when there is a factor that is not identified by human beings, but is influencing in a kind of deep and global level human history. That's the argument of late Victorian Holocaust by Mike Davis. The book is about a little known episode that had serious consequences. Means he identified a series of famine that hit the Indo-Pacific region between 1876 and the 90s, and that caused between 30 and 50 million deaths in several countries: India, China, Korea, Brazil, Ethiopia, Egypt. And Mike Davis established that they were all related to a variation of El Nino, which none of the contemporaries could have identified. And it's an example of deep causality of history. But in this book, he used this deep climatic cause to introduce another deep cause, which is the most decisive for him, which is the effects of global capitalism. His analysis of India serves to establish that the famine was not primarily linked to the lack of food, but to the inability to access it through the state of the market. And it was strongly influenced by Amartya Sen and how Amartya Sen analyzed the famine of Bengal in 1943. So the key point was about the incorporation into the European world system through colonization and how it was responsible for a set of famines. And you see on the cover, there is an up Lord Lytton, which was the vice king of India, and people were paying by journalists. People were starving and were paying for journalists for newspapers, English newspapers. And in fact, Lord Lytton forbid the distribution of food, because he thought he had the order to encourage the development of a world market of wheat. So, and the idea was, if you give food to people, they won't make any effort to have a more modern agriculture. The argument about India is absolutely right, but the complete argumentation is weak in many points. The weak point is the attempt to unify very different economic and social situation on the basis of a climatic catastrophe. Indian and Chinese farmers were incorporated into the market before colonization. The situation of Africa, which accounts for a third of the losses, is very different, because Africa didn't have centralized state like India and China, and thus it didn't present the same type of moral economy of nature. Northeast Brazil was a very different case at this time, because it was just after the destruction of the, because at the time when the region was destabilized by the abolition of slavery and the economic decline following the replacement of sugar plantation by coffee and rubber. So there is a climatic phenomenon, which is El Nino, but a set of diversity of political and social phenomenon. So what do we learn from history? Do we learn the effect of climatic variation? Or do we learn how different social and political systems are answering to the same situation? And the trouble with deep climate history is that there is no human subject corresponding to climate change. There is not something like a human subject, which is the human species. Biologically speaking, there is a human species. But culturally and politically speaking, it doesn't exist. And that's all the challenge. So I will prefer that much the concept of a trigger. Trigger was a concept proposed by Leroy Ladurie, because studying the French Revolution, he established that it was not possible to explain the French Revolution by climatic factors. Even though climate had an influence, what part of a story. But fundamentally, the engine of history is human. It was what Marc Bloch say in the Apology of History, because for matter, it has precisely in last resort human consciences. So my point is not to underestimate the influence of climate. It's more to propose a kind of a switch from causality to trigger, means that to enrich history, we can focus on working, of course, about events and monographs, but working about, vulnerability and about the threshold of acceptability, resistance, or resilience on a society in relation with climate. If you move from causality to this kind of history of acceptability, of resilience, you enter in a different perspective, which is a history of force fields. Force fields is also a concept coming from Leroy Ladurie. He didn't develop it. Just a title, a fascinating title in his book, Les Paysans de Languedoc, 1966. This book, which is just in the middle, was read from the pocket edition. But if you look in the first edition, 1966, there was a fascinating first part, which disappeared after, and that quite nobody read. And this part was named Fields of Forces, organized in three chapters: suggestion of a climate, plants and techniques of the South, migration and temptation of the North. And all this project was about the material constraint weighing on human history, climate, plants and techniques, human migration. It was a project of a biological and human history made of exchanges and circulation. But he didn't write this story. This project was identified by the philosopher Michel de Certeau at the same time in L'Écriture de l'Histoire. And he said that this project by Leroy Ladurie was very, very original, this chapter about the vegetal civilization. And it was a line in the 60s. It was the project of a human history of a nature. It was a project of a relation of a society combined with the becoming of nature, which is simultaneously a given and a work. And for Certeau, Leroy Ladurie was very close at this time to Michel Foucault. It was very close also to what Claude Lévi-Strauss was doing with structural anthropology in the 60s. Because if you read Leroy Ladurie, he proposed two directions. On the first hand, it was the interplay between constant and variables that defined the basis of a dialogue between anthropology and history. And these variables were climate, population, production, prices, income, health, etc. All the set of variables that we are finding again today with global climate change. And the second perspective was nothing. So, but for fear of being accused of determinism, especially of a part of Braudel, Leroy Ladurie classified climate as a minor variable. And if you look to what happened after in the 80s and 90s, it was the rising of political and cultural history. And all these biological and climate projects was quite vanished. And it stopped just there. But it's possible today to open it again. To open it again, a history that is both a given and a work. What does it mean? It means that there is no direct relation between climate and society, but that they pass through a series of mediation, a series of technical, discursive, and symbolic mediation. So the history of knowledge is central in two ways. On one hand, because it allows us to grasp how a materiality is understood and shaped. And on the other hand, because the historical sources are produced by this knowledge. And of course, we have to be very careful with the effects of reality of archives and sources, particularly for the categories of description of the climate that have a moral dimension, the miasma, the unhealthy, the corrupt. And it's another interesting point because I think that today there is a return of climate as a kind of political and moral category, and it will expand. And if you look to some recent book, a book by Locher and Fressoz about the history of climate as a category, you see that if you look to the early modern times, climate was basically a political category. And health and politics were strongly linked and linked with the empire. Another point is that there are many sources coming from physicians about climate that still have to be studied. Especially, a huge potential is coming from sources from the empire, the colonial empire, because historians of French colonies were absolutely not interested into environment and climate. It's opening to a new history, which is a history of limits, as a new field of research. How this field's forces can define different society. If you read the inaugural lesson of Leroy Ladurie in 1973, here at the Collège de France, he described a kind of société immobile, that is an ecological stable and almost demographically stable society from the end of the Middle Ages to the beginning of the 18th century. And this ecological equilibrium was a mix between subsistence, demography, health, and migration. It was a Neo-Malthusian thesis. It was the one that you find also in Braudel in some quotes, this idea of an organic society that was quite trapped in a set of constraints, obstacles, structures, relationships, numerical games. And it's exactly what we are going back in another way, because we are leaving the idea of an economic growth without any limits. And we are trying to understand this kind of limits that define a society. This history of field force is still to build and has a huge potential, especially for health and climate. But how human beings play inside field forces? And that's my last point, to call for a new history of social change. A new history of social change will be a renewed history of societal choices. I know that there are many books that are quite fascinating, trying to explain the collapse of ancient society by climate factors, the Mayas, Eastern Ireland, etc. But please look at all what anthropologists and historians are working, writing about, and how they say to be very firm about such phases. For example, there's this famous book, this bestseller by Jared Diamond about collapse, and there is an entire book who is criticizing him. I just take one just small example, the example about Greenland. Greenland. We know that Greenland, when climate was different, had a population of, had a Norse population from the since the end of the 10th century. But Norse people disappeared at the end of the 15th century, exactly at the time when climate changed. So the point is, why did they disappear? Is it because of climatic change and thus the phases by Jared Diamond? Two second arguments could be because of the advance of the Inuit, the Eskimos, may I play a role? And another point was about erosion. But if you read the chapter by the anthropologist specialist of Greenland, he say that the story was quite different. The story was quite different. It was a more cultural and social history. Because these people, these Norse people, they were belonging to a Nordic civilization, and they were strongly linked to an Atlantic and European world. So they had a way of life. They had a way of life that was based on a combination between hunting and fishing, and mainly on farming. And this way of life based on farming was linked to a hierarchical society, powerful farmers and clan leaders, was linked to the church as a basis for power structure, and was linked also to ivory traffic. So they could have adapted. They could have adapted. They could have abandoned farming and go to a different way of living. But the main point is that they didn't want to. So they didn't collapse. They just choose not to adapt because it was too costly. It means moving to a completely different society, a completely different way of living together, or making family, or making the rights of believing in God. So they just left. Choices means the link between choices and the physical configuration of a territory. Because choices, we are not completely free of doing it. An example that I really like is an example about the environmental history of car. You can take the curves of CO2 emission links to cars and say that's the story. But when you show the curve, you don't understand anything. You don't understand why do people choose to use cars and how they choose it. It's not also a story about loving or hating cars, which is the usual stories about speed or gender, etc. Christopher Wells established that the main point is about landscape, how we have inherited landscapes that were built for some technical elements. And in fact, he started his book telling that when he was a kid, when he was a young man in the US, he became free when he had a car. When he was 18. When he came to Europe for his PhD, he became free in European cities because he used a bicycle and they didn't need any more a car. And when he came back to the US, he decided to be free without a car. But that's absolutely not possible in some parts of the territory. So that's the main story. Another example that I really like, that was the MIT study about places. They make comparison between health indicators between two different types of places. Places that are used by cars. You can't make any public event. There is no market, nothing, just for cars. And places make for people. and there are daily markets, there are some public events, a kind of vibrant neighboring. And they establish a difference between both in terms of health cost, almost, if I remember well, of most of 10%. That's a physical configuration, which is strongly linked to health, because in the second case, you go out of your home, you socialize, you speak with people. So it means that it's possible to put into urbanism health indicators. So is it a point about adaptation of plasticity? I know that the concept of adaptation is really the key concept in climate change field research. But for anthropologists, that's quite a tricky concept. And Philippe Descola, who was professor ici, wrote an entire book, L'écologie des autres, to explain why adaptation is not a relevant concept to understand society. Because why no society have never been adapted to environment and climate? You can read the book to have all the elements. I just take a small example of plasticity. An example that I really like about environmental inequalities, ecology, and health. That's everybody is speaking about environmental inequalities, but I know quite no empirical historical studies about that. Is it true that environmental inequalities are always, put on the poorest people, the one who suffer from the other inequalities? That's not really true. That's more complex than that. There is a book by Andrew Orley about Gary, Indiana, which was an industrial city. And she established that since the 60s, there are no environmental inequalities in the city. Why? Because everybody was living in the center. The white people, the rich people, the Afro-Americans, the workers, because they were all proud of pollution. They are all proud of pollution because pollutions mean wealth. Win means prosperity. In the 60s, it was quite different. In the 60s, a new rising concern appeared about health. And there was a political coalition between workers, Afro-American, and white wealthy people, because everybody cares about the health of your children. And it was thanks to that the first black mayor of Gary was elected. And then, only in the 70s, environmental inequalities appeared when an ecological awareness grew, and so the white rich people left the city center, the Afro-American just stayed, and the workers, they had all this trouble with jobs. So to conclude, what perspective for climate change and health from this point of view of history? First, it's true that there was an underestimation of the importance of climate in the history of health. And many of empirical work has to be carried out. Considerable historical sources exist, but it's possible to combine with new sources such as iDNA, etc. A second point is that not limit yourself to the search for causalities, to a history of interference, and rather try to build a total perspective, including human choices in fields of forces and how they vary through temporal and spatial scales. And third point, I think so that health has a strong potential as an articulation between climate and society, because it is strongly linked to human lives. It does not act as a higher level, but is difficult to apprehend, such as climate. And one proof of that is that environmental mobilization on health issue, historically speaking, had a low level of environmental inequalities compared to other ecological issues. And that's a way of opening to a positive side of climate change issues. Thanks so much.